form.
And on this Ides of March, we have two Iris listeners celebrating birthdays today. Barb and I would like to wish happy birthday to Kenneth Smalley of Iowa City and Beverly Van Meter of Ames. Kenneth Smalley of Iowa City and Beverly Van Meter of Ames. Happy birthday from all of us here at Iris. There are also a few celebrity birthdays listed in today's register. Actor Judd Hirsch is 89 years old. Singer Mike Love of the Beach Boys is 83. Sly Stone of Sly and the Family Stone is 81. Singer Brett Michaels of Poison is 61. And actress Eva Longoria from Desperate Housewives is 49 years old. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not yet a registered IRIS listener, registered IRIS user is what the announcer is trying to say, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. You need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. And now back to Barb for an obituary.
In Des Moines, Kathleen Kate Krabs Tease, T-E-A-S, passed away on Tuesday, March 5, 2024, after a courageous battle with cancer. She was born April 13, 1956, to Rex and Harriet Krabs. A graduate of Norwalk High School, she continued to become a beautician and masseuse. A celebration of life will be held March 24th, 5 p.m. at Fraternal Order of Eagles, and that's at 6567 Bloomfield Road, Des Moines. And Margaret Jean Walsh, 90, of West Des Moines, died March 1st, 2021, and this will be held by a funeral mass at 10 a.m. Saturday, April 20, 2024, at All Saints Catholic Church by Reverend John Flattery. And the burial will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family after 9 a.m. before the service at the church. Tien Funeral Home and Cremation is serving the family. Margaret was the daughter of John A. and Mary Burke Walsh and was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa on December 10, 1933. And after graduating from Immaculate Conception High School in Cedar Rapids, she earned a bachelor's degree in liberal arts from Marquette University and a master's degree in library science from the University of Wisconsin. Margaret served 2 years as a librarian with the Milwaukee Public School System and spent the rest of her career with the San Francisco Public Library System. She enjoyed the beauty of the San Francisco Bay Area and trips along the Oregon coast. In 2017, Margaret moved back to Iowa to be close to her family members, and she celebrated many holiday dinners in their homes. Intelligent and well-read, Aunt Maggie impressed her nieces and nephews with her conversation, wit, and easy laugh. She is preceded in death by her parents. In lieu of flowers, may we suggest a donation to your favorite charity in her memory. Condolences may be left at Tehen Funeral Home, TEAHENFuneralHome.com. /obituary/Margaret-Walsh.
Continuing with news from page 3A of today's Des Moines Register, Vice President Harris visits a Minnesota abortion clinic. This story by the USA Today, Dateline St. Paul. Vice President Kamala Harris made a historic visit to an abortion clinic in St. Paul, Minnesota on Thursday, demanding that the U.S. be a nation that trusts women as access to reproductive medical care has come under assault. The visit to the Planned Parenthood facility marked the Biden campaign's most dramatic push to make access to abortion a defining issue in the 2024 election. It was the first time a U.S. president or vice president has visited a clinic that provides abortion services. Harris, the nation's first female vice president, has become the White House's leading voice on restoring abortion rights after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, ending a 50-year constitutional right to an abortion. Harris said, "In this environment, these attacks against an individual's right to make decisions about their whole body are outrageous and in many instances just plain old immoral. How dare these elected leaders believe they are in a better position to tell women what is in their best interest?" The trip was the final stop of Harris's Fight for Reproductive Freedoms tour, which launched in January and included visits to Wisconsin, California, Georgia, Michigan, and Arizona. While Biden struggles to convince Americans of an improving economy, according to the polls, abortion rights has proven to be a winning issue for Democrats in elections since 2022. The Biden campaign has set out to relentlessly remind voters that it was former President Donald Trump's three Supreme Court appointments who led to Roe's dismantling. The recent Alabama court decision protecting embryos awaiting IVF implantation as extrauterine children has added yet more fuel to the fire. Trump said in a Fox News town hall in January that he is, quote, proud to have done it when asked about the court's overturning of Roe versus Wade. He later added that he supports exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. Vice President Harris was joined at the clinic by Minnesota's Democratic Governor Tim Walz and Democratic Representative Betty McCollum. Walz signed legislation last year codifying the fundamental right to an abortion in Minnesota and repealing the state's 24-hour waiting period before an abortion. Harris said, after touring the St. Paul Health Center Vandalia, which remained open to patients at the time, "Many of you have asked, why am I here at this facility? It's because right now in our country, we're facing a very serious health crisis. And the crisis is affecting many people in our country, most of whom are frankly silently suffering." Harris highlighted the many services Planned Parenthood provides that are unrelated to abortion, such as pap smears, vaccines, diabetes screening, and menopause treatment. She said, "Please do understand that when we talk about clinics such as this, it is health care. So everyone get ready for the language. Uterus. That part of the body needs a lot of medical care from time to time. Issues like fibroids. We can handle this. Breast cancer screenings. Contraceptive care." She said she believes shutting down clinics that provide those services was one of many potentially intended consequences of the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade in 2022. Still, abortion was front and center. Minnesota has become a safe haven for people from states that have passed bans on abortion in the nearly 2 years since Roe was overturned. Sarah Traxler, chief medical officer for Planned Parenthood North Central States, said, "Since Roe was overturned, I've cared for patients from everywhere, from nearby states like South Dakota and North Dakota and Wisconsin, but from faraway states too, like Texas, Alabama, Wyoming, Florida, Oklahoma, Missouri, and the list goes on." Traxler said the St. Paul Abortion Clinic has seen a 25% increase in abortions since the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization decision that overturned Roe. Out-of-state patients have doubled, she said. Harris called the St. Paul Clinic an example of what true leadership looks like. "It is only right and fair that people have access to health care they need," Harris said, "and that they have access to health care in an environment where they are treated with dignity and respect." A heavy police and Secret Service presence surrounded the building in anticipation of the vice president's arrival. In the course of the half-century battle over abortion rights in the U.S., abortion clinics have at times been targets of violent protest, including shootings and bombings. An hour before Harris was scheduled to speak, about 24 protesters gathered outside the St. Paul Planned Parenthood, holding signs with slogans saying such as, "Life is a human right," "They're killing babies here," and "The real war on women." Diana Halsey, a 70-year-old Minneapolis resident, was among those hoisting signs with anti-abortion slogans. She said she stops by the clinic about once a week to pray that the women coming and going get the help that they need. She was surprised to learn that Vice President Harris also would be dropping by yesterday and hurried to find a bigger sign. As Harris drove by, Halsey's large "Life is a Human Rights" sign was on immediate display. "It's sad," she said of Harris's visit. "I really feel bad about our medical community that they are not supporting." On the other side, Paige Robinson, a 22-year-old University of Minnesota student, was among a handful of supporters who gathered outside the clinic on Thursday, intermingling with the protesters, trying to catch a glimpse of the vice president as her motorcade exited the building. Robinson, a Democrat, said of Harris's visit, "I think it's very cool. It's nice to see such clear support of our pro-women policies."
Flint in contempt for slow waterline replacement, Paul Egan. Lansing, Michigan, a federal judge has found the city of Flint, Michigan, in contempt of court for missing deadlines to replace lead water pipes and do related work after the city's water crisis. U.S. District Judge David Lawson found the city in civil contempt for violating a February 2023 court order. In a 2017 settlement, the city pleaded to replace lead pipes that carry drinking water by early 2020. But the city still has not finished, according to the news release Wednesday from the National Resource Defense Council. In addition, homeowners are waiting, in some cases for years, for the city to repair property damage such as the ripped-up curbs, sidewalks, and lawns caused by the lead line replacement, that the council said. The city has failed to abide by the court's orders in several respects, Lawson wrote in a Tuesday order. It has no good reason for its failures. The court's decision to hold the city of Flint in contempt reflects the depths of disgust and despair felt by Flint residents, said Melissa Mays, one of the plaintiffs and operations manager for the nonprofit Flint Rising. Flint's water crisis began in 2014 when a state-appointed emergency manager switched the city's drinking water supply from Lake Huron water treated in Detroit to Flint River water treated locally. The decision was disastrous. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality failed to require necessary corrosion control chemicals in the water treatment process. And as a result, the lead leached into the city's drinking water from pipes and fixtures. Though the city has replaced lead water lines at tens of thousands of homes, it hasn't completed outreach to several dozen homes. A recent survey showed that at least 275 still had lead pipes lines, though many of those may have declined to participate in the replacement program. At least 2,000 homes have damaged curbs, sidewalks, and lawns from the replacement work, and the city has repeatedly failed to comply with the court-ordered requirements to document all the work it has completed, according to the filings in the case. The city said in court filings that it has taken all reasonable steps to comply with the court's orders. The city blamed winter weather for some of the most recent delays. The city is committed to continuing to replace lead service lines above and beyond the terms of the NRDC settlement as long as funds are available, Flint attorney William Kim said in a statement. To date, the city of Flint has completed service line identification and replacement at 29,485 addresses. The contempt finding was made in a lawsuit brought against the city and state in 2016. The judge said that he will reimburse the plaintiffs for the cost of bringing a violation to the court's attention if they file required paperwork. Other than offering to award attorneys' fees, costs, and expenses to the plaintiffs, the judge's order did not set out other penalties for the city if it continues to fail to comply. Lawson cited the city's strained finances as one reason for declining to set penalties, as well as the fact that the city came into compliance with three specific issues that prompted the contempt motion while the motion was pending. The case is separate from another Flint lawsuit, which has also been settled, under which Flint residents were awarded $626 million to compensate them for lead poisoning. No Flint resident has yet received payment under that settlement as delays continue in the claims administration process.
And moving to international news now, an aid ship is bringing 500,000 meals to Gaza. Israel has done security check of the vessel and its cargo. This story by USA Today. The first humanitarian aid ship from Cyprus was due to arrive at war-battered Gaza on Thursday with more than 500,000 meals from Chef Jose Andres's World Central Kitchen. Crews were working on preparing a jetty at an undisclosed location to unload Open Arms, the first ship bringing aid to the enclave that has been left in ruins by more than 5 months of war. The nonprofit organization said in a statement it was working with United Arab Emirates, Cyprus, and the international community to open the maritime aid corridor. The group said, "Once there, we will distribute the food to communities on the brink of famine." The Israeli military said a comprehensive security check of the ship and its cargo of almost 200 tons of rice, flour, beans, lentils, and canned meats had been completed. A second ship was being prepared to make the trip. The group says it has already provided more than 35 million meals to displaced Palestinians in the region since the war began. The United States is sending material for construction of a floating dock that would expand access to aid ships. The dock, when fully operational within 2 months, should be able to offload up to 2 million meals a day. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas plans to soon name a close ally and economic advisor, Mohammed Mustafa, as his new prime minister, resisting international calls for the organization's reform. Meanwhile, displaced Palestinians will have to be on the move again, this time to humanitarian islands. Israel plans to relocate a large portion of the 1.4 million people sheltering in Rafah to protect them from its anticipated major offensive in the southern Gaza Strip city as it pursues Hamas militants, the Israeli Defense Forces chief spokesman said on Wednesday. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said at a press briefing, "We need to make sure that 1.4 million people, or at least a significant amount of the 1.4 million people, will move. Where? To humanitarian islands that we will create with the international community." The United States, its allies, and multiple aid organizations have warned of a humanitarian catastrophe if Israel invades Rafah, where more than 60% of Gazans are now located, the majority of them refugees from other parts of the territory trying to escape the war. Israel says it must destroy four Hamas battalions in Rafah to complete its mission of crushing the militant group. Hagari said civilians would be redirected to central Gaza and provided water, food, and shelter, though he didn't say when the mass mobilization might start. The U.S. and fellow mediators Qatar and Egypt tried to broker a ceasefire before the Muslim holy month of Ramadan began this week, but to no avail. The Biden administration has pressed Israel to devise a workable strategy to spare innocent people in Rafah from the bloodshed that has left more than 31,000 dead and 73,000 injured in Gaza as Israel responded to Hamas's attacks of October 7th. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told reporters in Washington, "We need to see a plan that will get civilians out of harm's way if there's a military operation in Rafah. We have not yet seen such a plan." Senior officials in the White House have told Israeli officials that President Joe Biden would support efforts to target key Hamas leaders in Rafah if Israel avoids a large-scale invasion of the city. The administration is concerned that a military offensive in Rafah would further strain waning global support for Israel's effort to destroy the militant group. Politico, citing private conversations, said top administration officials have signaled support for counterterrorism operations rather than an all-out war. That's according to four U.S. officials. Such a plan would minimize civilian casualties and decimate Hamas's ranks without the intense images of suffering that have fueled opposition to Israel's military effort. Such a plan, however, has not yet been formulated, Politico said. Counterterrorism troops found a multiple rocket launcher next to a school and rockets under a bed in the home of a Hamas operative in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis, the Israeli military said on Thursday. Israel has blamed the high civilian death toll from the Gaza military operation on the militants' use of human shields. Yemen's Houthi rebels claim to have a new hypersonic missile in their arsenal, according to Russian state media, potentially raising the stakes in their ongoing attacks on shipping in the Red Sea and surrounding waterways against the backdrop of Israel's war on Hamas in the Gaza Strip. The report by the state-run RIA Novosti news agency cited an unnamed official but provided no evidence for the claim. It comes as Moscow maintains an aggressively counter-Western foreign policy amid its grinding war on Ukraine. However, the Houthis have for weeks hinted about surprises they plan for the battles at sea to counter the U.S. and its allies, which have so far been able to down any missile or bomb-carrying drone that comes near their warships in the Mideast, in the Mideast waters. The Houthis, a military official close to the Houthis, said the group's missiles forces have successfully tested a missile that is capable of reaching speeds of up to Mach 8 and runs on solid fuel. The Houthis, the official said, intend to begin manufacturing the missile for use during attacks in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, as well as against targets in Israel. Mach 8 is 8 times the speed of sound. Meanwhile, Iran and the U.S. reportedly held indirect talks in Oman, the first in months amid their long simmering tensions over Tehran's rapidly advancing nuclear program and attacks by its proxies. Iran denied claims that U.S.-Iran talks in January had addressed Houthi militant attacks on Red Sea shipping. Iranian officials told state-run IRNA news agency that the talks solely involved Iranian sanctions.
Schumer calls for new elections in Israel, and this is written by Mary Claire Jelonek, Mary Claire, and Ellen Nickmeyer, Washington. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on Thursday called on Israel to hold new elections, saying that he believes that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lost his way and is an obstacle to peace in the region amid a growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Schumer, the first Jewish majority leader in the Senate and the highest-ranking Jewish official in the U.S., strongly criticized Netanyahu in a 40-minute speech Thursday morning on the Senate floor. Schumer said that the prime minister has put himself in a coalition of far-right extremists, and as a result, he has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows. Israel cannot survive if it becomes a pariah, Schumer said. The high-level warning comes as an increasing number of Democrats have pushed back against Israel, and President Joe Biden has stepped up public pressure on Netanyahu's government, warning that he needs to pay more attention to the civilian death toll in Gaza amid the Israeli bombardment. The U.S. this month began airdrops of badly needed humanitarian aid and announced that it will establish a temporary pier to get more assistance into Gaza via sea, a pier. Schumer has so far positioned himself as a strong ally of the Israeli government, visiting the country just days after the brutal October 7 attack by Hamas and giving a lengthy speech on the Senate floor in December decrying brazen and widespread anti-Semitism, the likes of which we hadn't seen in generations in this country, if ever. But he said that on the Senate floor Thursday that the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past. Schumer says Netanyahu, who has long opposed Palestinian statehood, is one of the several obstacles in the way of two-state solution pushed by the United States. Netanyahu has lost his way by allowing his political survival to take precedence over the best interests of Israel, Schumer said. Schumer also blamed right-wing Israelis, Hamas, and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas until they are all removed from the equation, he said, there will never be peace in Israel and Gaza and the West Bank. Schumer said the United States cannot dictate the outcome of an election in Israel, but a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel at a time when so many Israelis have lost their confidence in the vision and direction of their government. Netanyahu has long had a more cozy relationship with Republicans in the United States, most notably speaking at a joint session of Congress in 2015 at the invitation of the GOP lawmakers to try to torpedo former President Barack Obama's nuclear negotiations with Iran. The move infuriated Obama administration officials, who saw it as an insufficient end run around Obama's presidential authority and unacceptably deep interference in U.S. politics and foreign policy. Just this week, Netanyahu was invited to speak to Republican senators at a party retreat. But Israeli Ambassador Michael Herzog took his place due to last-minute scheduling issues, according to a person familiar with the closed-door meeting. It is unclear how Schumer's unusually direct call will be received in Israel, where the next parliamentary elections are scheduled for October 2026. Many Israelis hold Netanyahu responsible for failing to stop the October 7 cross-border raid by Hamas, which killed 12,000 people, mostly civilians, and his popularity appears to be taking a hit as a result. Protesters in Israel calling for early elections have charged that Netanyahu is making decisions based on keeping his right-wing coalition intact rather than Israel's interests in a time of war. And they say that he is endangering Israel's strategic alliance with the United States by rejecting U.S. proposals for a post-war vision for Gaza in order to appease the far-right members of his government. U.S. priorities in the region have increasingly been hampered by those far-right members of his cabinet who share Netanyahu's position in Palestinian statehood and other aims for that successive U.S. administrations have seen as essential to resolving Palestinian-Israeli conflicts in the long term. In a hot mic moment, while speaking to lawmakers after his State of the Union address, Biden promised a come-to-Jesus moment with Netanyahu. And Vice President Kamala Harris, Schumer, and other lawmakers met last week in Washington with Benny Gantz, a member of Israel's wartime cabinet and a far more popular rival of Netanyahu, a visit that drew a rebuke from the Israeli Prime Minister. Gantz joined Netanyahu's government in the wartime cabinet soon after the Hamas attacks, but Gantz is expected to leave the government once the heaviest fighting subsides, signaling an end to the period of national unity. A return to mass demonstrations could ramp up pressure on Netanyahu's unpopular coalition to hold early elections. Schumer said that as the highest-ranking Jewish elected official in the United States, he feels an obligation to speak out. He said that his last name is derived from the Hebrew shomer, or guardian. I also feel very keenly my responsibility as shomer Israel, a guardian of the people of Israel, he said. Schumer said that if Israel tightens its control over Gaza and the West Bank and creates a de facto single state, then there should be no reasonable expectation that Hamas and their allies will lay down arms. It could mean constant war, he said. As a democracy, Israel has the right to choose its own leaders, and we should let the chips fall where they may, Schumer said. But the important thing is that Israelis are given a choice.
And our final story together before the next crew moves into the studio. Prosecutors are open to a delay in Trump's hush money trial. This story by the Associated Press, Dateline New York. New York prosecutors said Thursday that they are open to delaying the start of Donald Trump's New York hush money criminal trial by up to a month to give the former president's lawyers time to review evidence that was only recently turned over. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office said in a court filing that it's not opposed to adjourning the start of the trial for up to 30 days. Jury selection in the trial is scheduled to begin March 25th. At least it was. Trump's lawyers are seeking a 90-day delay or the dismissal of charges against Trump, alleging violations of what's known as the discovery process, where the sides exchange evidence. The new records came from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, which previously investigated the hush money arrangement at the heart of Trump's New York criminal case. The defense has also sought to delay the trial until after the Supreme Court rules on Trump's presidential immunity claims, which his lawyers say could apply to some of the allegations and evidence in the hush money case. The U.S. Supreme Court is scheduled to hear oral arguments on August 25th. The state judge in the hush money case, Juan Manuel Merchan, has yet to rule on either request. Since March 4th, Trump's lawyers have received at least 84,000 pages of records from the federal prosecutor's office in Manhattan, including a batch of 31,000 pages on Wednesday of this week. The records pertain to a federal investigation that touched on the hush money matter and led to prison time for former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen. Federal prosecutors in 2018 charged Cohen with campaign finance violations related to the hush money payments, with evading taxes related to his investments in the taxi industry, and with lying to Congress. Cohen, who blamed Trump for his legal troubles, pleaded guilty and served about a year in prison before being released to home confinement because of the COVID-19 pandemic. He is now a key prosecution witness in the Manhattan District Attorney's case. Trump and his lawyers have portrayed Cohen as completely untrustworthy. Well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb Martin and Dave Buzik. It's been our pleasure to read for you, as always. And now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place here in the studio. Have a good weekend.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Jim Hoffman and my name is Rachel Mithelman. We'll continue with the opinion pieces from today's USA Today and then look at the sports page from the Des Moines Register. Here's Jim with our next article.
Thank you, Rachel. Good morning, everyone. We're going to start off on the opinion page from USA Today. Have an article entitled Free Medical School Leaves Life-Saving Legacy. This written by Dr. Jessica Faiz and Dr. Utibi R. Essien. Jessica Faiz is an emergency medicine physician and assistant professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. And Utibi R. Essien is a generalist, an assistant professor, and associate vice chair for equity, diversity, and inclusion at the David Geffen School of Medicine as well. Memories of our medical school years at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine still linger. Lifelong friends, memorable professors, caring for sick patients across the Bronx. And finally, a decade removed from graduation, our monthly student loan payments. Living in New York City was not cheap, along with the $50,000 per year of tuition, now up to $61,688. It costs to attend Einstein. And so, like many medical students across the country, we took out large loans to support our dreams of becoming doctors. Nonetheless, our medical education at Einstein undoubtedly established our passions as physician researchers dedicated to advancing health equity and diversifying the physician workforce. When we saw recently that former Einstein professor Ruth Gottsman had committed $1 billion to help provide free tuition in perpetuity for all students at our alma mater, we immediately began to imagine what this gift would mean for training doctors of diverse backgrounds. Doctors who could represent the Bronx, a county whose residents are 44.3% Black and 56.6% Hispanic, and provide the best care for patient populations most in need. Regrettably, the latest data on medical school diversity is dismal. 5.7% of all doctors in the United States are Black, while 7% are Hispanic, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. When we were at Einstein, Black and Hispanic students made up only 10% of the student body. A large part of the underrepresentation of minority groups in medicine is financial barriers to applying to medical school, due to decades of structural racism resulting in wealth gaps. A study we published in the Journal of American Medical Association's Health Forum last April showed just how important these financial barriers are. We found that Black and Hispanic students were more likely to report limited access to financial resources and higher pre-medical debt burden. These students, in turn, were up to 18% less likely to apply to and matriculate at medical school compared with white students. In the wake of the Supreme Court ruling last summer banning affirmative action in higher education, institutions have been brainstorming how to preserve racial and ethnic diversity in their classrooms. One of these solutions is to eliminate economic barriers on the pathway to medical school, which offering free tuition to students certainly addresses. Eliminating medical school costs as a barrier for students who never considered medical school as an option will provide an opportunity for them to change their family's financial trajectory. These are students who will become doctors who can communicate with their patients in their native language, understand and relate to patients who must choose between paying for rent or prescription medications, and recognize the myriad structural barriers that students less privy to these forms of adversity may not appreciate. We know that this understanding can both improve patient experience and health outcomes. Free tuition might also encourage students to pursue high-need but traditionally lower-paying specialties such as primary care after graduation. During our training at Einstein, the patients we served suffered the highest rates of devastating complications from chronic diseases such as diabetes and high blood pressure. In the Bronx, 16% of patients have diabetes, while 32% have hypertension. Through this $1 billion gift, Einstein now has a unique opportunity to train a racially and ethnically diverse physician workforce committed to providing care to communities like the Bronx and helping mitigate these health disparities and combat medical racism. We are not naive to believe that philanthropy alone will improve physician diversity and health equity. New York University's medical school became more competitive after it implemented free tuition in 2018. And the risk remains that economically and educationally privileged students will disproportionately climb to the front to take advantage of this benefit. Thus, to ensure diversity, the Albert Einstein College of Medicine must continue to prioritize holistic medical school application reviews, community education investments, and targeted recruitment of students underrepresented in medicine. Beyond Einstein, we need federal commitment to eliminate tuition burden for pre-medical and medical students, especially those attending schools without the same access to generous philanthropy. Finally, with the alleviation of medical school debt, Einstein should develop more dedicated tracks for primary care training and for students committed to practicing in the underserved communities after graduation. As proud Einstein alums, we are thrilled for the generations to come who will reap the benefits of Ruth Gottman's donation. This outsized gift personifies our teaching at Einstein to address root causes of structural inequities, including in education. Our alma mater is now well positioned to develop future physicians from the community it serves and to widely transform health equity in the Bronx. We hope other schools will follow.
The second piece on the USA Today opinion page is by Carly Pearson. She's a digital editor at USA Today and an attorney. She recently finished a legal consultancy with Equality Now, an international feminist organization working to eliminate sexual violence and discrimination against women and girls. The title of the piece is Sleepover Debate Comes Down to Protecting Your Loved One. I recently wrote about whether to allow my 8-year-old daughter to attend sleepovers, and something about my dilemma clicked with many readers. I got emails from as far away as Australia from parents and grandparents telling me that they, too, had strong opinions about the great sleepover debate. I was touched by the reactions to the column. Several parents and grandparents wrote to tell me that it sounded like I was doing great as a mom. Never hurts to hear that. I had only a few mean emails, which is rare for an opinion column. I had emails from fathers and grandfathers, police officers and lawyers, and they wanted to let me know that they too understand what it is like to take on a determined 8-year-old and push back on social pressure to do what other parents might be doing. One father wrote to say, "My kids didn't come with an owner's manual, so if anybody has a spare, please send me the PDF, otherwise I'm going to make it up as I go." I couldn't agree more. A mother wrote to say, "Nothing good happens after midnight." I can say from experience that is very true. Another woman wrote that she avoided the argument by starting a Girl Scouts troop and organizing group sleepovers where adults supervised and participated in the sleepover. That sounded like a good solution. And for the readers who wanted to know what I told my daughter in the end, before I got all this great advice from people writing in, it was this: if you're just going to sleep, then you can sleep at home. I let her go to her friend's house for a while, and I stayed to have a glass of wine with the mother, and then we left together. But what you say to your kid or what you decide to do about a sleepover invitation is only half of the issue. The real issue we need to talk about here is sexual violence. When I wrote about my dilemma of whether to let my daughter go to a sleepover, it was for me about the risk of sexual violence. It's hard to talk about sexual violence. It always has been. It's still a taboo subject in most households, but avoiding talking about it doesn't make it go away. Many people wrote to share stories of their experiences with sexual violence, explaining that was the reason they wanted their kids home at night. One man told me that he had been a victim of sexual violence as a child in the foster care system. He said he never let his kids attend sleepovers, but he could never bring himself to tell them why, because he felt that he would have to tell them what happened to him. One reader wrote to say that I didn't need to bring up the issue of rape or sexual abuse with my young daughter, and I wholeheartedly agree. She is only 8. I do, however, talk to her about why no one can touch her in a way that makes her feel bad, and that she must tell me if anything bad ever happens, that I will never get angry with her for telling me the truth. If you think such concerns are irrational, I'd point you to a still-developing story out of Oregon where a father is accused of drugging 3 12-year-old girls who attended a sleepover with his daughter. The father was indicted on 9 counts last month. The reality is that sexual abuse of children is rampant. According to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, 1 in 9 girls and 1 in 20 boys under the age of 18 are victims of sexual abuse or assault. 82% of victims are under 18 are female. Females ages 16 to 19 are 4 times more likely than the general population to be victims of rape, attempted rape, or sexual assault. The problem is at epidemic levels in the United States, and simply denying a child a sleepover isn't enough to keep them safe. Kids need to understand that they can talk to their loved ones if anything bad happens to them or someone else they know. As adults, parents, caregivers, and guardians, we need to have conversations about consent and bodily integrity, albeit in an age-appropriate way, based on facts and expertise. Parents need to talk with one another. Schools need to talk to kids about sexual health and safety. As I said in the initial column, I know that I can't keep my kids safe from everything, forever. But I am trying my best to keep them safe now when they are under my care. Keeping my daughters safe means talking to them about hard topics and setting firm boundaries that cannot be moved simply because my kids really want something or because everyone tells me it's fine. That by Carly Pearson of USA Today.
Thank you, Rachel. And turning to sports here for a little bit. We have the sports schedule on TV. There's just a ton of college basketball men's with all of the tournaments taking place. The Big Ten tournament, a lot of you are probably interested in. That's on Big Ten Network, and it's on all day long, starting at 11 o'clock today. And then there's game at 1:30, and then later on in the evening, we have games on the Big Ten Network at 5:30 and 8 o'clock, the quarterfinals. There's also the Conference USA tournament on CBS Sports Network starting at 11:30 today. On ESPN, they've got the Southeastern tournament. ESPN2 American Athletic Tournament So lots of tournament basketball, conference championships will be decided today and this weekend. College basketball for the women on ESPNU at 4 o'clock. We have the America East Tournament, Vermont at Maine, the championship. There's golf at noon today on the Golf Channel, PGA Tour, the Players' Championship, second round. And Major League Baseball at 3 o'clock today has a spring breakout. San Diego Padres prospects play the Seattle Mariners prospects in Arizona on the Major League Baseball Network at 3 o'clock. We have the Register Athlete of the Week, Jesse Van Calsbeek. Maurice own Orange City, Floyd Valley boys basketball player Jesse Van Calsbeek was voted the Des Moines Register's Iowa Ortho Athlete of the Week winner for the week of March 4th to the 10th. Van Calsbeek won Athlete of the Week with 57% of the vote. Valley boys basketball player Curtis Stinson Jr. finished second with 29% of the vote. Van Calsbeek was sensational in two tournament games for Maurice Orange City Floyd Valley. In the 3A quarterfinals, Van Calsbeek went for 37 points, 14 rebounds, and 5 steals during a 67-50 Dutchman victory over defending champion Bondurant Farrar. Van Calsbeek then put up 31 points on an impressive 15 of 20 shooting performance in a 76-66 semifinal loss to Waverly Shellrock, adding 6 rebounds and 3 steals and 3 blocks also against the Gohawks. There was no female athlete of the week for the time period since the girls' basketball season came to an end the previous week and spring sports had not yet started.
And a short article about Drake women's basketball before we move to Dear Abby. Drake women win 3 major MVC awards. This is by Tommy Birch. The Drake women's basketball team's successful season included 26 victories, a Missouri Valley Conference single-season record 19 wins in league play, and an outright regular season title. The Bulldogs were richly rewarded for their accomplishments Wednesday night. Junior guard Katie Denebier was named MVC Player of the Year. Allison Pullman was selected as Coach of the Year, and Anna Miller was picked as the Defensive Player of the Year. The long list of accolades came as the Bulldogs, last season's MVC tournament champs, prepare for their second straight crown. All 3 made compelling cases and played huge hands in Drake's success this season. Denebier may have been the biggest contributor. The former Waukee standout averaged a team-high 18.1 points and 3.2 rebounds per game. Denebier, who tallied just the second triple-double in program history this season, led the MVC in assists, averaging 7 per game. Pullman, a former assistant for the Bulldogs, has guided Drake back to glory in her third season at the helm. Drake went 19-1 in MVC play and became the first men's or women's hoops team in league history to win 19 or more conference games in a season. The Bulldogs enter this week's tournament as the top seed and will take on either number 9 seed Indiana State or the 8 seed Southern Illinois in the quarterfinals on Friday at noon. Miller, a junior forward, averaged 13.2 points and ranks first in the league in rebounds at 9.9 and blocks at 2.7. Denebier, along with teammate Grace Berg, was named to the MVC's first team. Miller was a second team pick. Denebier and Miller were also named to the all-defensive team. Northern Iowa's Maya McDermott and Grace Boffoli were first team selections as well. So that about the very successful Drake women's basketball season. It's time to turn to Dear Abby for today. I'll read the first letter in response if you'll take the second one, Jim. Dear Abby, 3 years ago, our 40-year-old daughter Tanya suddenly accused me of abusing her during her childhood. She also accused my husband, her dad, of enabling this abuse. Abby, the abuse never happened. Could some therapist have planted these ideas in her head? Tanya has problems with alcohol, which she blames on me, and has been divorced from two wonderful men who she claims also abused her. She can't maintain friendships with women because as soon as they do something that makes Tanya mad, she cuts them off. Our other daughter, Nadia, is 3 years younger. She doesn't have an alcohol problem and has a great husband and a toddler. Tanya has cut her off as well and has never met her brother-in-law or nephew. Nadia says her childhood was idyllic. Neither child lives near us. My husband is living with incurable cancer, which Tanya knew before she excommunicated us. I don't know if I should inform her when her father dies or let her find out through others on Facebook. My husband and I and Nadia don't use Facebook, but relatives do, and I'm sure they will make it known. I am torn about this. Tanya has hurt all of us repeatedly for so many years that we all agreed that life is more pleasant without her around. However, I'm afraid not telling her will cause more problems. Advice? This is signed, Damned Both Ways in Illinois. Abby writes, Dear Damned, you stated that Tanya has excommunicated you, her father, and her sister. She appears to be an angry and bitter woman who needs to find someone other than herself to blame for her unhappiness. She's unlikely to improve without professional help or an alcohol intervention. When your husband passes, I'm hoping you will write her a brief letter explaining that you want her to know that her father loved her. Give her the date of his passing, his obituary, and the location of his final resting place. If you do, your conscience should be clear. What, if anything, she decides to do with that information is up to her.
And our second Dear Abby letter. Dear Abby, I had a long and wonderful marriage before my husband passed away after a lengthy illness 3 years ago. I have supportive friends to go to lunch and coffee with, but I miss the companionship of a special someone. One of them is a man I have known for many years. He's been a widower for more than 10 years. Before my husband's passing, he once said if I wasn't married, he would call me. He hasn't contacted me. How can I contact him without seeming aggressive? He has said that he's pleased with his current companion because there is no drama. Please advise. Signed, Classy in California. And Abby writes, Dear Classy, consider this. Throw a small party and invite some of your friends to join you. Then pick up the phone and ask this gentleman if he and his lady friend would like to join you.
That's Dear Abby for today. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Friday, March 15th. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. Earlier, you heard Barb Martin and Dave Busick. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.